Defense Secretary Rumsfeld said that if Iraqis fire on American planes enforcing a no-fly zone, that would constitute a material breach of the UN Security Council and therefore give us the right to invade. But the UN did not authorize the no-fly zones. These were unilaterally imposed, initially as an emergency humanitarian gesture, but since then largely as an excuse to keep bombing Iraq. So legally speaking, these are foreign military aircraft infiltrating a sovereign nation's airspace, and Iraq has every legal right to shoot at them if they decide to.
That's Stephen Zunis, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Stephen Zunis on the case against war with Iraq. Addressing troops at Fort Hood, Texas, President Bush warned, "The Iraqi regime is a grave threat to the United States. The drums of war are beating loudly for an attack on Iraq. The reserves have been called up. Carrier battle groups are in place. The U.S. is anticipating an 18-month occupation that will involve, reports the New York Times, a heavy American military presence and a quick takeover of Iraqi oil fields." Beyond the rhetoric and gunship diplomacy, Bush has not made the case that a major invasion of Iraq is necessary. Historian and longtime peace activist Howard Zinn says, "A war against Iraq has no logical connection to the tragic events of 9/11. We have a right to wonder if the motive for war is not stopping terrorism, but expanding U.S. power and controlling Middle East oil." Stephen Zunis is a specialist on the Middle East. His articles appear in leading journals and magazines. He teaches at the University of San Francisco and is chair of its Peace and Justice Studies program. He also serves as Middle East editor for the Foreign Policy in Focus project. He's the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, published by Common Courage Press. Professor Zunis spoke at the University of New Mexico at Albuquerque.
September 11th raised some serious questions about the very concepts of American security. Both supporters and critics of U.S. foreign policy had to rethink a lot of things. As Americans watched in horror as the towers burned and collapsed, one of the big questions that came to mind was why. And we were told by our leaders and much of the media that we became targets of international terrorism because they hate our freedom. They hate our liberties. And while I'm as proud of our individual liberties and democratic institutions as any American, the sad reality is that our foreign policy in the Middle East has not been about freedom and democracy. It's been about supporting autocratic governments and occupation armies. People in the Middle East don't see our freedoms at work. They see made in USA, our tear gas canisters, and bomb casings. U.S. military aid to the Middle East is 6 times greater than all U.S. economic aid. The number one commercial export from the United States, more than consumer goods, high-tech equipment, agricultural products, is armaments. These weapons have often been used to suppress incipient human rights movements. We have the nerve to say, oh, they don't have democracy in that part of the world because it's not in their culture. And then we end up sending massive arms to Israel, which uses these against Palestinian civilians because they are, in our words, the sole democracy in the Middle East. It's not a coincidence that Osama bin Laden's first attack against U.S. interest, which took place in 1995 in Saudi Arabia, was against U.S. servicemen who were training the Saudi National Guard, which is used exclusively for internal security, that is, repression. Remember, the Saudi government, despite being called moderate by much of the media and officials in Washington, has no constitution, has no legislature. It's an absolute monarchy. like a number of our allies over there. It is somewhat ironic that the United States, the first republic to be born in rebellion against monarchy, is now the principal backer of the few absolute monarchies remaining. It's important to recognize that extremist Islamic movements have never risen in stable democratic societies. And yet, in the name of fighting Islamic extremism, the United States has supported militarization, has supported autocratic governments, and supported some of the very policies from which these manifestations of which have brought many of these movements to prominence. It reminds me of during the Cold War, how the United States, in the name of fighting communism, would support these right-wing military dictatorships. But they would actually end up creating more communists, because as people desirous of social reform, economic reform, freedom from repression, would be driven underground. And the only viable opposition was the Marxist-Leninist guerrillas out in the countryside. In a similar way, this is what we're doing in the Middle East, where open opposition is suppressed. People are driven into the arms of the extremists because it's much more difficult for the state to get into the mosques. Secular groups are easier to track down and keep track of. It reminds me of President Kennedy's famous quote, "Those who make peaceful evolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable." As most Muslims will tell you, Osama bin Laden doesn't know much about Islam. But he is a businessman by profession. And like any good businessman, he knows how to take a perceived popular need, desire, or grievance and translate into selling his product. His product is anti-American terrorism. So he doesn't talk about how bad American freedom and democracy is, because he knows most people in that part of the world would like to have more freedom and democracy. What he talks about is the permanent U.S. military presence in the heart of the Islamic world, the American support for brutal dictatorships, the humanitarian consequences of U.S. policy towards Iraq in terms of the sanctions and bombings and threatened war, the support of the Israeli occupation and repression of the Palestinians. Now, very few people in that part of the world support Osama bin Laden's ideology or his methods, yet those grievances have widespread appeal over there. The vast majority agree with those grievances. So even if only a tiny percentage of the population decides they think terrorism is a good idea, that's still enough people to bring in more recruits. And this is important because all the sophisticated weaponry, all the brave fighting men and women, all the brilliant military leadership this country has will do us little good if there are millions of people in that part of the world who hate us. And this does not mean that we give in to extremists. We give in to terrorists, of course not. But what it does mean is that if there are policies that are of questionable legitimacy anyway, and these policies are creating a kind of reaction that is threatening our national security, we need to look more critically at those. It's easy to dismiss these people as evil, crazy, pathological, which, given the kind of things that they've done, is probably not an unfair characterization. And yet it's important to note that there's a difference between terrorist groups at the far left and far right that rise out of Western democratic societies and can easily be suppressed, like the Semenese Liberation Army, the Bader-Meinhof Gang, Red Brigades, groups like that, because they don't have much appeal. And why would you resort to terrorism if you have an open political system you can work through? If there's hope of making change, through nonviolent means. More difficult are the terrorist groups that spring out of societies where there are systematic grievances across society as a whole that they feel are not being met. In addition to suppressing the terrorists, you also need to look at the underlying political grievances. And that's what the Good Friday Accord, for example, in Northern Ireland did. And this is what has not yet come to pass among Palestinian Arabs, Sri Lankan Tamils, and others who believe, rightly or wrongly, that there is a systematic injustice against them. And a radical fringe has been able to take advantage of these popular grievances to engage in acts of terrorism and create a sustainable base to make these operations possible. I raise this because I've been traveling to the Middle East for nearly 30 years now. And I think it's become pretty clear that the more the United States has militarized the Middle East, the less and less secure we become. That's a major theme in my book. And I've talked about it in other contexts as well. And I think a very good illustration of the pitfalls of the current direction in policy is in the current determination, it appears, by the administration to make war on Iraq. So I want to focus most of my remarks today on that question, because I fear if the United States does invade Iraq, we will be making a major mistake. There are enormous costs that appear would come from this that don't seem to be justified due to the lack of evidence the Bush administration has put forward regarding the necessity. So let me run down some reasons that I personally believe that a war against Iraq would be wrong. First of all, there's been no credible evidence of any Iraqi connections with al-Qaeda or the September 11th attacks. None of the hijackers were Iraqi. None of the leaders of al-Qaeda are Iraqi. None of the money trail seems to be traced to Iraq. You can't say the same for Saudi Arabia, but they're a U.S. ally, so we kind of overlooked that one. Reports of a meeting in Prague between one of the hijackers and an Iraqi intelligence operative have been investigated by the CIA, the FBI, Czech intelligence. Absolutely no evidence that such a meeting ever took place. There have been credible reports of al-Qaeda operatives that have been fighting Afghanistan being seen in Iraq. But these are exclusively in northern Iraq, in the autonomous Kurdish areas, out of the control of the Baghdad government. It would seem very odd that there'd be any kind of alliance between the secular Ba'athist regime in Baghdad and the Islamist al-Qaeda movement to begin with. Saddam Hussein has brutally suppressed Islamist movements within Iraq. His vice president and his foreign minister are from Christian families. He has refused to support Islamist movements despite requests from various factions in various parts of the Islamic world. Meanwhile, Osama bin Laden has declared that Saddam Hussein is an infidel, an apostate, a traitor to Islam. In fact, offered to raise an army of mujahideen to fight Iraq when it invaded Kuwait back in 1990. Iraq did support terrorist groups in the past, particularly in the 1980s. But these were all secular nationalist groups. And it's interesting how the height of Iraq's involvement in international terrorism back in the 1980s, the United States dropped Iraq from its list of countries sponsoring terrorism. Why? Because if you're on that list, you can't get American military aid or certain dual-use technologies. And the United States wanted to sell these to Iraq to help them in their war with Iran. In fact, the seed stock of the anthrax for Saddam Hussein's biological weapons program came from the United States. Many of their chemicals for their chemical weapons program, came courtesy of the U.S. taxpayer as part of agricultural subsidies, because supposedly these chemicals are being used for fertilizers. Indeed, we have evidence from congressional testimony that the Commerce Department and others actually covered up records showing the American role in supporting Saddam's weapons of mass destruction program. According to the State Department's annual report, the latest version, Patterns of Global Terrorism 2001, there is no evidence that Iraq is currently involved in international terrorism directed at the Americans. The most they could say was that the Iraqi government had offered sanctuary for these aging former terrorist leaders of now defunct organizations. And apparently, just to make sure that the U.S. wouldn't take advantage of this fact, apparently Iraqi agents murdered Abu Nidal in his Baghdad apartment last August. He was one of the more notorious terrorist leaders that Saddam Hussein had previously backed. Iraq has offered cash assistance to families of suicide bombers, Palestinian families whose family members have been involved in suicide bombings against Israeli civilians. But this is part of a package that the Iraqi government has sent to all Palestinians who are killed in the struggle against Israel, including Palestinian militiamen defending their towns from occupation, Israeli occupation forces, teenagers in protest who are gunned down by Israeli occupation troops and the like. And certainly Iraq is not the only country in the Arab world that does this. Again, Saudi Arabia has raised money for families of suicide bombers as well. What concerns me is that a war against Iraq would actually distract from the more important campaign against terrorism. Because when we're dealing with al-Qaeda, we're talking about a decentralized network of underground terrorist cells. You need to be able to track them down. You need good intelligence. You need cooperation from other governments. And a U.S. invasion of Iraq would create increased anti-American sentiments that would make it less likely for governments and individuals to assist the United States in this. Indeed, the anti-American anger could lead to increasing acts of terrorism, because if you take out one of the few nation states willing to challenge the United States' role in the Middle East, people may be more prone to support irregular groups in challenging U.S. policy in the region. Indeed, if there is any logic to the madness of 9/11, I believe it was the hope that the United States would overreact and do something like this. It would invade a sovereign Arab country and create this massive anti-American backlash. Indeed, I cannot think of anyone who would be happier if the United States invaded Iraq than Osama bin Laden himself. And it's interesting how none of America's Gulf War allies in the Middle East support the United States invading Iraq. Unlike 1991, which was seen as the legitimate act of collective security, responding to aggression by one country, Iraq, against another, Kuwait, this is seen in the eyes of even fairly moderate to conservative Arab leaders as an act of imperialism. The Arab League unanimously, in their meeting in Beirut last spring, voted to say, this is wrong. No country has a right to invade any Arab country, including Iraq. A more recent meeting by Arab foreign ministers in Cairo warned that a U.S. invasion would open the gates of hell. And again, there is this concern that there's going to be an anti-American backlash. They're already furious at the United States for its double standards, saying we need to bring democracy to Iraq when we're supporting dictatorships virtually everywhere else in the Arab world, of saying we need to enforce UN Security Council resolutions when Iraq violates them, but we allow Israel and Turkey and Morocco and other U.S. allies to violate UN Security Council resolutions with impunity, to say Iraq cannot have weapons of mass destruction while allies like Pakistan and Israel have weapons of mass destruction. So please understand whether or not you are personally a supporter of the war. And they believe their differences with Iraq vis-a-vis these other countries. The perception in the Middle East is that issues around democracy, Security Council resolutions, weapons of mass destruction are not what it's about. They're excuses. They're not the reason. And remember, the Arab world has suffered conquests from the West for many decades. They're very sensitive about this kind of thing. And resistance would be widespread, even among the vast majority of people in that part of the world who don't like Saddam Hussein. The other thing I want to mention, this is very important. We hear a lot about the weapons of mass destruction. But it's rather startling, the fact that the United States has refused or been unable to produce any clear evidence that Iraq even has weapons of mass destruction. Now, personally, I wouldn't be surprised if they do. I think they probably have some left over. But there's no proof, which makes an idea of an invasion even of a more dubious in my mind. And that's why inspectors are important, to find out what's there. But when the Iraq agreed to let the inspectors come back in September, the United States said, oh, the inspections don't work, we're going to invade anyway. And it was only through enormous pressure by the international community that the United States agreed to let the inspectors go ahead, but only after rewriting the rules more to make the inspections regime even stricter. It's important to recognize that in the Gulf War, which remember, this is the heaviest bombing in world history, several times more than all the bombs dropped by all sides in World War II were dropped on Iraq in just a six-week period. Virtually all of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, delivery systems, and weapons production capability was destroyed during the Gulf War and by the inspections that followed. Unfortunately, President Clinton pressured the head of UNSCOM, the Weapons Inspection Group, to withdraw from Iraq in December 1998 before their job was complete, and then engaged in a four-day unauthorized bombing campaign, which, as was predicted at the time, gave Saddam Hussein the excuse to refuse to resume the inspections until this fall. Now, at that time, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which had been allowed full access, unlike UNSCOM, declared that Iraq's nuclear program had been completely eliminated. Richard Butler, the head of UNSCOM, declared that 817 of Iraq's 819 Scud missiles had been accounted for and destroyed. They may have up to 20 of a homemade variety, but they'd never been tested. It's not clear whether their launchers even work. Scott Ritter, the chief inspector, estimates that 95% of Iraq's chemical weapons capability was accounted for and destroyed. Biological weapons are a bigger question, but the problem with biological weapons is that it's not the kind of thing you just put on a warhead because it'd be destroyed at impact. You need special kind of nozzles, special kind of delivery systems, presumably a subsonic aircraft, presumably a drone. And given that the U.S. Air Force controls the skies in that part of the world, and there's very sophisticated anti-aircraft systems in all the surrounding nations, I can't imagine that would get very far before it would be shot down. So when you hear reports of saying Iraq may have the capability of have enough biological weapons agents to kill millions of people, it's kind of like saying that a man has enough sperm to impregnate millions of women. It's a matter of delivery systems. So what I'm saying is that the threat doesn't seem to be that high. In fact, the last 3 years of UNSCOM inspections, they were unable to find any proof that Iraq had been hiding anything. And what's interesting is that, remember that Iraq developed its weapons of mass destruction only because of imports from the West of raw materials and technology. And that has been illegal. That's been banned for the past 12 years as a result of the sanctions. So you really don't have that much to make weapons from at this point. But let's assume for a moment that somehow Iraq does have a sizable arsenal of weapons of mass destruction and delivery systems, which they may. Why would he use them? The only thing I trust about Saddam Hussein is his ruthless determination to hold on to power at all costs. He knows that using weapons of mass destruction against the United States or any of its allies would be suicidal. There'd be massive retaliation. It's called deterrence. It works against other ruthless dictators like Stalin, Mao, those who are at least as nasty as Saddam Hussein, and far more powerful, far more capable of hurting the United States. But we trust the deterrence would work. People say, though, but he's used weapons of mass destruction before. You know, back in the 1980s. That's true. Of course, the United States has used weapons of mass destruction, the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but that doesn't mean we're about to go and start nuking people. Saddam Hussein used his chemical weapons against the Iranian troops during the war because he knew Iran didn't have any allies. In fact, the Washington Post and other media have reported that officials of the United States Defense Intelligence Agency were on the ground in Iraq assisting the Iranians in targeting Iranian forces, assisting the Iraqis in targeting Iranian forces, and the full knowledge that the Iraqis were using chemical weapons. Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against Kurdish civilians because he knew he couldn't fight back. And what did the United States do? We covered up for the Halabja massacre and similar attacks by falsely claiming it was the Iranians who did it. In other words, Saddam Hussein is a coward. He'll use weapons of mass destruction when he thinks he can get away with it. But if it's going to result in harm against him, no way. He didn't use them in the Gulf War when he was being attacked by the largest coalition of forces ever assembled against a single country in world history. Why would he, out of the blue, when he's far weaker than he's been before, use weapons of mass destruction? People say, well, maybe he'll give it to these terrorists, and they'll do it. Well, another thing about Saddam Hussein, those of you who know anything about Iraqi politics know he's the ultimate control freak. He doesn't want any decisions of any consequence made unless he has direct control of it. And he's not going to go to the risk and expense of developing weapons of mass destruction and give them to a terrorist group that he cannot control, particularly these Islamist crazies who just as soon use these weapons against him. And remember that biological agents, some chemical agents, are traceable. And they'd be like a return address that says Baghdad. And again, then there's this issue of deterrence. What's interesting about all this is to please remember that Iraq was far more powerful in the 1980s. Back then, it had its full complement of ballistic missiles, its full complement of chemical and biological weapons. It was well on its way to developing nuclear weapons. Its army was 3 times bigger than it is today. Its military spending is estimated to be 10 times bigger than it is today. They had a functioning navy, which they don't have anymore, a sizable air force, which is largely grounded.
You're listening to Stephen Zunis on the case against war with Iraq. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling the following toll-free number, 1-800-444-9222. 1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering.
Why then that Iraq is just a fraction, just a shell of its former military prowess, are we all freaked out that they're an immediate threat to our national security? And back then, the 1980s, when they were real powerful, we were supporting them. So it just doesn't make sense. It defies credibility. And yes, particularly since 9/11, we can think of these worst-case scenarios. But can you imagine if every country in the world gave itself the right to invade another country because they think they might be developing weapons that they might someday use against them, or might pass on to some terrorist group or whatever? I mean, you'd have countries invading each other all over the place. It certainly does not fit in any standard definition of self-defense, whether you look at Article 51 of the UN Charter, just war theory from various religious traditions, or almost any other criteria. This, worst-case scenario idea, particularly against a country that is very weak militarily, and on the other side of the world, from that the world's biggest superpower is saying, oh my God, they're a threat to us. And remember, Iraq's immediate neighbors don't see Iraq as a threat. And the Kuwaitis and the Saudis, the Jordanians, Turkey, they haven't said, help us out, we're scared of what Iraq might do. They're not worried. Where are we? Another thing to think about, but there are, again, there are alternatives. For example, I've been part of a group of peace and conflict studies people, international relations scholars, and others, who, through a number of non-governmental organizations, have been putting together meetings of Iraqi officials, Iranian officials, Saudi officials, Kuwaiti officials, in fact, representatives from all eight governments, all eight countries that border the Persian Gulf. These aren't high-level officials. We haven't gotten there yet, but these are mid-level officials that are, have connections. And we've been talking about building a regional security pact where there'd be arms control, where there'd be early warning and other confidence-building measures, where there'd be a non-aggression pact. We've met twice in Cyprus, once in Istanbul, once in Qatar, and we've been making slow and steady progress. But what's revealing is how hostile the United States is to our efforts. It reminds me some of the U.S. attitude towards the Contadora group and President Oscar Arias of Costa Rica when they tried to get a regional peace and security pact together for Central American nations. And the United States tried to sabotage it at every point. There's another issue I want to raise about why I think the war is a bad idea is that it's going to be costly to Americans. We're not going to have the equivalent of the Northern Alliance, like in Afghanistan, to do the fighting for us. Iraq's infrastructure is far more sophisticated than Afghanistan's. We're not talking about a Pashtun tribesman. We're talking about a fairly sophisticated armed force, albeit one that's certainly been crippled by the sanctions and the like. Unlike Operation Desert Storm, which was in flat open desert, most of the fighting in this war would be in central Iraq, which is a heavily populated agricultural and urban area. Saddam Hussein withdrew all his elite forces from Kuwait prior to the start of the war, replacing them with undertrained, underarmed conscripts, primarily from minority communities, in some cases literally chained to their bunkers. So it was a fairly easy fight once in that 100-hour ground war that the United States launched. By contrast, there are 6 to 8 divisions of the elite Republican Guard in central Iraq right now, ready to defend the capital. These are loyalists who, unlike the conscripts, are not likely to defect. And the inspections regime and all that was only geared towards Iraq's offensive military capability, not his defensive capability. And remember that Baghdad is a city of 5 million people. Yes, we have all these high-tech, laser-guided, remote-operated weapons and stuff, but still, to capture a major capital city, you need infantry to actually physically be there. And the risk of house-to-house fighting, of Black Hawk Down scenario, multiplied a couple hundred times, is a very real possibility. And remember how I mentioned that Saddam Hussein would not use nuclear, or he would not use weapons of mass destruction and offensive capability because it would lead to massive retaliation, and his first and foremost desire was to survive. What if he knew he was going to lose anyway? What if he knew he was going to die, his regime was going to fall, as American troops marched on Baghdad? He had nothing to lose. That's the logic of self-preservation would no longer work. Then, if he does have weapons of mass destruction, I could and very well see Saddam Hussein doing this. Indeed, the CIA had a report out recently that said exactly that. So in other words, an invasion of Iraq, instead of preventing the use of weapons of mass destruction, would be the most likely scenario, indeed, in my mind, the only realistic scenario, that these weapons might indeed be used, and be used against Americans. In any case, the United States, in order to protect its forces, will engage in a heavy air campaign. And I wouldn't put it past Saddam Hussein, of course, to put his anti-aircraft positions and things in these narrow alleyways of urban areas. And the result, of course, is going to be widespread civilian casualties. And even putting aside the humanitarian concerns, the thousands of innocent Iraqi civilians who die, is the fact that what we find in the Arab Islamic world now, that what they didn't have 12 years ago, is satellite television. And the scenes of death and destruction are going to be broadcast throughout the Islamic world in living color. Is that really going to make us more safe? And then, of course, what do we do after we win? As Afghanistan demonstrated, it's easier to throw out a government than put one in. There's a risk of ongoing resistance. Again, most Iraqis, I think, will be quite glad to see Saddam Hussein go, but please remember that that doesn't mean they necessarily want him to be replaced by a chosen leader of a invading Western army. We could see ourselves in counterinsurgency warfare in urban areas, which is pretty ugly. But of course, what happens if the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south decide they don't want to be part of any government based in Baghdad, and they take advantage of the collapse of Saddam Hussein's army to rebel? The United States certainly doesn't want this, because a successful Kurdish rebellion in the north could spread to the Kurds in Turkey, our NATO ally. Or successful Shiite rebellion in the south could spread to the rest of Shiite populations in northeastern Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Bahrain. And remember, many of the Shiite groups have close ties to the Iranians. The United States may find itself in a counterinsurgency war against the very minorities who have supposedly been trying to protect through these no-fly zones. And again, I want to mention that I really don't think our goal is democracy there. If you look at the names of leaders, had them tossed around by American officials that we want to install to replace Saddam Hussein, every one of them is a former general of Saddam Hussein, who's defected in the past 10 years or so, but nevertheless took part in the intense war crimes in Kurdistan during the 1980s. Indeed, when has the United States ever supported democracy in the Arab world? And we should not exaggerate the threat. While it's easy to exaggerate the threat from Iraq, we've been hearing all the time, we should not exaggerate the nature of the regime. It really is a nasty regime. I've been there. It is totalitarian. It's fascistic. It's pretty bad by whatever measure you have there. But if you look at how regime change has taken place, when these dictatorships have been overthrown in the past few decades, it's not been through an external invasion. In only a few cases has it been through an armed indigenous rebellion. Virtually all the dictatorships that have been toppled through non-violent people power movements, like the movements that ousted the communist regimes in East Germany and Czechoslovakia, the dictatorships, Southeast Asian dictatorships of Marcos in the Philippines and Suharto in Indonesia. We've seen such rebellions bring democracy to places like Bangladesh, Bolivia, Haiti, Zambia, Madagascar. There have been more gradualistic nonviolent movements that have led to democracy in South Korea, South Africa, Chile, Argentina, Brazil. Remember, it was not 11 weeks of NATO bombing that brought democracy to Yugoslavia. It was a year and a half later with a nonviolent people power movement by the Serbs themselves. It was largely the urban middle class that has led these rebellions. But what's happened to the urban middle class in Iraq? It's been devastated by the war, by the sanctions, the hyperinflation. They've been reduced to poverty. Many have been forced to emigrate. And they've been replaced by a new class of black marketeers who have a stake in maintaining the status quo. And on top of that, if you are dependent on the government for your rations to feed your children, you're even less likely to take the considerable risks of challenging the government. I've talked to quite a few Iraqis about this. And virtually every one of them has said, had the United States pursued a very different policy these past 12 or 13 years, Saddam Hussein would no longer be in power. He would have been ousted by the Iraqi people themselves. Finally, I want to emphasize that a U.S. war against Iraq would be illegal. UN Security Council Resolution 1441, recently passed with a lot of pressure from the United States, does not authorize any member state to use force against Iraq. They have warned Iraq of severe consequences if they don't cooperate. But it also says in Article 14 that the Security Council decides to remain seized of this matter, which is basically UN speak for saying that the Security Council, and the Security Council alone, will decide what to do if Iraq violates the resolution. Indeed, Articles 41 and 42 of the UN Charter are very clear that no member state can unilaterally enforce a Security Council resolution, only if the Security Council as a whole determines that all non-military means of enforcement have been exhausted and then specifically authorizes the use of force. The Security Council did just that in late November 1990, with a fair amount of arm twisting from the United States, to enforce its resolutions demanding Iraq withdraw from Kuwait. But once Iraq pulled out of Kuwait, that resolution became moot. And they have not authorized any military force against Iraq since then. I mean, if the United States can enforce this resolution militarily, what's stopping France from invading Turkey? Or Britain from invading Morocco? Or Russia from invading Israel? They're in violation of UN Security Council resolutions as well. It's amazing. The other day, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld said that if Iraqis fire on American planes enforcing the no-fly zone, that would constitute a material breach of the UN Security Council and therefore give us the right to invade. But the UN did not authorize the no-fly zones. These were unilaterally imposed, initially as an emergency humanitarian gesture, but since then largely as an excuse to keep bombing Iraq. So legally speaking, these are foreign military aircraft infiltrating a sovereign nation's airspace, and Iraq has every legal right to shoot at them if they decide to. This is not grounds for invading. And remember, there are over 100 UN Security Council resolutions that are currently being violated. And this idea we keep hearing that the United States has to enforce this resolution or the credibility of the UN is at stake is ridiculous. The United States has used its veto power to block the United Nations Security Council from even passing resolutions during the past 30 years, more times than all the other 5 permanent members have used their veto power combined. And of the ones we have passed, in most cases, we have blocked their enforcement because they've involved U.S. allies. So, in other words, I don't think we're doing this because we want to keep, for the sake of the integrity of the United Nations. Because, you know, we often hear that, you know, the debate, well, should the United States be the world's policeman? But to me, that's not even a debate. I mean, a policeman, at least in theory, is someone who enforces the laws uniformly, that has a legally constituted authority to do so. So we're not even talking about being the world's police, we're talking about being the world's vigilante. There's a big difference. And so especially in contrast to 1991, we would be the invader. We would be seen as the international outlaw. And in other words, a U.S. invasion of Iraq, I think, would reinforce the very issues that have engendered so much anger and resentment at the United States. Now, I don't want to imply in any way that the September 11th was somehow karmic or we deserved it or it was our fault or anything like that. No matter what a country does, in its foreign policy, no one deserves what happened on September 11th. But I think it underscores a very important point that I think we need to look critically at what kind of role the United States has played in that part of the world. And I think it's really important that we inform ourselves. And it's interesting that as Middle East scholars have been talking about this, we have become targets by right-wing groups tied to the Bush administration. There's a group called Campus Watch, where they encourage students to get dossiers on their Middle East studies professors and report anything that is perceived to be anti-American or anti-Israel or at all sympathetic to what they see as the enemy. And it's nothing really new here. We saw this, Latin American scholars were similarly trashed back in the 1980s when the U.S. was intervening in Central America because they dared point out that it was not just this conspiracy hatched in Moscow that led the peasants of El Salvador and elsewhere to rebel, but there might be some social conditions on the ground that have helped create a revolutionary situation. Similar attacks were used against Southeast Asia scholars in the 1960s, the U.S. got involved in Vietnam. It's kind of like the people in Washington are launching their own preemptive strike by saying it's the academics who are the ideologues. It's the academics who are biased and don't know what they're talking about. And yes, there is an underlying anti-intellectualism within the current administration. Remember, these are the folks that say there's no scientific evidence of global warming and President Bush himself has said there's not enough evidence to support Darwinian evolution as opposed to the creationism. So it's not too surprising that they would not take people who know the region very seriously. But I think it's important that ordinary Americans inform themselves and understand what may lead to the kinds of perceptions, the kind of anger we see now projected towards the United States. Because the United States has done some bad things in the third world before. But the Vietnamese and Nicaraguans didn't fly airplanes into buildings. It's important to figure this out now, because it does have a very real and very immediate impact. And this is particularly important because this is a major shift in U.S. foreign policy. Yes, the United States has overthrown governments before, violated international law before, but these are generally either like covert operations or they're done under the veneer of some collective security agreement, like through the Organization of American States, Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, NATO. Not always convincingly, in my view, but at least there is an attempt to put it, you know, within this idea of collective security and multilateralism. But not anymore. This is an unprecedented repudiation of the very basic international legal standards that have been built up this past century, where the United States played a disproportionate role, including our presidents, like Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt. If you read the neoconservative journals that these policymakers with the Bush administration have written for, or read their own national security documents about new policy, they are essentially embracing a concept of U.S. policy that parallels the verbiage that we used to associate with the left-wing critics, that is, America as empire. They don't usually use the word empire, but they have said imperium in a couple places, and Pax Americana, and hegemony. And when you think about it, there is a certain logic. If you are the number one military power in the world, in fact, you have 10 times more powerful military than anyone else, that your collective military spending is half the world's total. You have effective control of international financial institutions like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, WTO, and the like. I mean, you got a lot of power there. And so, you know, the attitude is, well, if you got it, use it. And again, what if we could do control Iraq, have a nice vassal state there? We're on top of the second largest oil reserves in the world. You can forget about OPEC raising prices anytime soon. We can have military bases right in the heart of the Middle East. Remember, we still have military bases in Japan and Germany 57 years after the end of World War II. And think of the countries that border Iraq and the leverage we would have over Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Turkey. Yeah, there is a kind of strategic logic to it, but it's a 19th century strategic logic. And as anybody who knows about the history of the Middle East, Western powers who've tried to control the Middle East have ended up getting bloodied pretty badly. And the stakes are a lot higher now in this era of megaterrorism and weapons of mass destruction. And it raises the question, is this the kind of country you want to see? In many ways, you're paralleling the debate of the turn of the previous century when the United States invaded the Philippines at the end of the Spanish-American War. And that question was republic or empire. And many leading intellectuals at the time, like Mark Twain, were active in the Anti-Imperialist League and started challenging these very kinds of assumptions. Because, you know, when George W. Bush was running for president, he scored a lot of political points in that second debate with Al Gore by calling for greater humility in U.S. foreign policy. We shouldn't engage this nation building and overreach. Why did he say that? Because he knew that had a lot of appeal among Americans, not just traditional anti-war people on the left, but most Americans are uncomfortable with the United States overreaching. And this is what we need to recognize, this is what we need to challenge, because the fundamental issue here is that the United States has become targets of violence not because of our values, but because we strayed from those values. So what I see here is an unprecedented convergence. An unprecedented convergence among those who have talked about U.S. foreign policy in terms of ethical issues like human rights, international law, and those who look at U.S. foreign policy solely in terms of U.S. national security. Because the fact is, they're one and the same now. You cannot separate them. And I really believe that the only real way the United States will find security is in recognizing that our greatest assets are not in our weapons of destruction or our far-flung military might, but in the caring and the fortitude and the noble values of the American people. Thank you.
That was Stephen Zunis on the case against war with Iraq. He spoke at the University of New Mexico at Albuquerque. Professor Zunis teaches at the University of San Francisco and is chair of its Peace and Justice program. He's the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, published by Common Courage Press. For more information on Iraq, you can contact Voices in the Wilderness in Chicago at 773-784-8065. Their website is iraqpeaceteam.org. Again, their website is iraqpeaceteam.org. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent award-winning weekly series. AR has a series of programs on Iraq and the situation in the Middle East, featuring Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, Scott Ritter, Hanan Ashrawi, and others. To access our catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for the complete one-hour program you just heard, The Case Against War with Iraq, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or you can send in your check. CDs and cassettes are $15. Printed transcripts are $9. Our address, AR, P.O. Box 551, Boulder, Colorado, 80306. Joe Gardner-Wesley recorded the program. I'm David Barsamyan. We close with John Trudell singing Bombs Over Baghdad from A.K.A. Graffiti Man on RICO.
Vampires, drinking blood and oil cocktails. Their violence works, it hardly ever fails. Bombs over Baghdad, dancers with death. Murder in the air, with the next breath. Macho queen, selling war makers' toys. Rain and destruction, good old boys. New world order, it's a whole world line. Fighting for peace, watch them all die. Dragon and God, as they turn violent. God says nothing, he just remains silent. Bombs over Baghdad, dancers of death. 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 Bombs over Baghdad.